It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Is cooking not your thing because there's just too much fiddling to do? Well, what if you could set your oven at around 200 degrees, put simple chicken and vegetables in there, and forget about them for maybe 6 hours? No fuss, no fiddling, and supper for a couple of days. Well, today we talk the science and the art of cooking slow. Prepare for a surprise or two. We protect all kinds of heritage, art, buildings, treasured foods. Why not antique grapevines? I mean, we certainly protect the wines they give us. And what does the chef who headed the kitchens at Chez Panisse cook when he's home alone? Well, stay with us for all sorts of answers and lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're doing something important here at The Splendid Table this holiday season. We're partnering with Feeding America to bring assistance to people who are hungry. 1 in 7 households in the U.S. have difficulty providing enough food at some point during the year. Hunger happens in every community, rural or urban, and it impacts all of us. When you support The Splendid Table now, your gift will help provide meals to people in need through Feeding America's network of member food banks. In these months of feasting and celebration for many of us, let's remember those who are doing without. Learn how to help at splendidtable.org/give. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. What does a man, the former chef of a place people practically worship, what does he think of home cooking? Chef David Tennis was raised in the house of Chez Panisse. David went from humble fill-in baker to heading the Chez Panisse kitchens on and off for more than 25 years. Well, he finally left to write, among other things, the City Kitchen column for the New York Times. His latest book is One Good Dish. It's a book about intimate, simple cooking at home. Our contributor, J.J. Good, met up with David in New York.
Hi, David. Thanks so much for being here.
J.J., so nice to be here. Thank you.
I think it's hard for a lot of us who got into food, say, 10 or 20 years ago to imagine how novel a restaurant like Chez Panisse was when you worked there, because I think today so many restaurants sort of embrace the Chez Panisse ethos. What made it so different then when you started working there?
Back in the dark ages?
Back in the dark ages. How long ago was it?
Well, actually, this is still the dark ages. I think I began working there in the 80s. The restaurant opened in the early 70s, at which point I was already sort of friends with Alice and a lot of people that worked there. But, you know, there weren't any restaurants like that at that point. There wasn't any great produce to be had. There were good home cooks. There were some high-end sort of continental restaurants, and I mean continental, with quotation marks around it. And, you know, then there was like the sort of the San Francisco Fisherman Wharf type restaurant, but as far as honest cooking and something that wasn't high French, it was, you know, sort of peasant French and, you know, run by a bunch of really smart college dropouts.
Was it?
Yeah, essentially. They weren't all dropped out, but essentially, you know, people who whose parents imagined they would go on to, you know, careers as lawyers and doctors, and they said, let's open a restaurant.
All right. And so you found your way there. Had you been cooking beforehand in restaurants?
Yeah, I had had some restaurant experience before I worked at Chez Panisse. And at the point when I began working there, I was working as a baker, as a bread baker. That's the way I got in, actually. I'd known Alice for years, but she wasn't that interested in hiring me for whatever reason. But when the bread baker went on vacation, at that point they were making all their own bread in-house. I substituted for him while he was gone.
Sneaky.
And then I sort of like stayed. And then over the years, over the course of 25 years or more, I would have stints at Chez Panisse for you know, short periods, and then go off to New Mexico for a period, and then come back, and then go to Paris for a period and then come back. And
so that's an interesting. That's how it was the whole time? You kind of asking Alice for a little leave?
It's just kind of the way things worked out. But when you talk about Chez Panisse as being a novel kind of restaurant, it still is.
It still is.
Because of that kind of flexibility. I asked for a raise 1 year, and they said, no, we're going to send you to Europe for 3 months. and it was, you know, it was an eye-opening experience for me. And that kind of flexibility is something that is part of the culture there.
Right. And at some point, you developed a really interesting arrangement with Alice or and the restaurant.
In the last few years. I mean, now that arrangement has sadly finished because I'm now beginning to figure out what I should be when I grow up, and I decided to leave Chez Panisse and move forward or onward. But for a number of years, I would split the job of the downstairs chef, downstairs being the slightly fancier restaurant, upstairs being the cafe, with Jean-Pierre Moulet, who also had worked there. Actually, he started before I did.
Whoa.
But I was living in Paris at the time, so I would come from Paris to California, spend 6 months. When I was there, he would go, he's French, he would go to Bordeaux and spend the summer at Arcachon. And so we would flip that way. But the whole idea of having two chefs is something that Alice was always interested in because, well, for one thing, it meant that there were more voices in the conversation, essentially.
Right.
So that, and I actually completely believe in that. You end up with a better product, you know, because I'm all for somebody having a better idea than me.
Right.
You know, or we bat it back and forth, and suddenly from a good dish, it becomes a great dish.
Do you remember any dishes that took shape that way? Any particular dishes or too many to count?
Too many to count.
Too many to count. So at some point, you finally decided to leave altogether, as you said, to figure out what you wanted to be when you grew up. What do you want to be when you grow up?
I don't know, but I thought a little break from the professional kitchen would be good. I'm actually I'm really passionate about home cooking, and in the past several years, I've been writing cookbooks. But the cookbooks are not they're meant for home cooks. They're not fancy sort of chefy cookbooks at all, because I really think that one of the saddest things about modern times is that people don't know how to cook anymore and people don't cook at home. I mean, that's a sort of broad generalization, but
right.
I think it could be said to be true, especially in the U.S.
Right.
So it's important. Things begin to unravel when people don't cook at home. I don't know why.
So I noticed in your new book, there are several recipes that call for only three or four ingredients: a radish salad with creme fraiche, garlic rubbed toast. Is there a challenge in writing recipes that are that simple?
Well, it's true that everything in the book is a simple recipe. There are hardly any any recipes that are more than it's pretty much one recipe, one page, and they're short. That's the kind of cooking that I think people can be doing at home. Every meal doesn't have to be, you know, sort of a big orchestra. There can just be a little tune that you sing at home at night when you're cooking for yourself. Even when I was working in restaurants, I would always come home and make something for myself after a shift. I didn't like eating during work. So I'd come home at 11:30, midnight, and make a bowl of pasta, but a really delicious bowl of pasta. So those are the kinds of things that are in this book. This book is saying, maybe you don't have time to do a three-course meal, but you certainly have time to make one good dish. You know, the process isn't difficult. You know, you smell the olive oil, you smell the garlic.
Right.
You make it taste right. Then you sit down and you eat it, whether it's yourself and a friend or a few people. It doesn't have to be a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Thank you so much for being here, David.
JJ, thank you.
David Tanis is author of One Good Dish. J.J. Good is co-author with Andy Ricker of Pock Pock. Well, David left us with a recipe for scorched peppers and onions, and you can find it on the website splendidtable.org. We are the scrappers when it comes to our heritage. Groups who see a threatened monument, a significant home, or a piece of art fight like the devil to keep it. But who fights for wine? I mean, we save it once it's in the bottle, but how about saving what that wine comes from? old antique vines. You know, the vines that builders eye and think bulldozer. Well, I bet you haven't pondered them much, but Ray Isle has. He's pondered them a great deal. And this is logical, since he's the executive wine editor of Food & Wine magazine. Ray, good to have you back.
It's great to be back, Lynn. Thanks.
Now, you did a piece on historic old vines in California. Mm-hmm. And we see that term, old vines, on the label a lot. But what's the story behind this?
Well, I mean, what's interesting is that when you see it on the label, it actually doesn't – it has no legal meaning, which is kind of strange. I could bottle a wine tomorrow from two-year-old vines and just label it old vines on the label. And I could also label it reserve, which also has no legal meaning.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But what's going on in California, what's kind of interesting is there's a kind of a movement to look at some of these historic vineyards as kind of cultural patrimony as well as simply agricultural land. And a couple of winemakers who are particularly into this, a guy named Tegan Pasalacqua and Morgan Twain Peterson, are two of them, started a group called the Historic Vineyard Society. It's a nonprofit to try and kind of identify these older than 50 or 75 or 100-year-old vineyards that really kind of speak to both, you know, the sort of California's, you know, immigrant communities in the early 1900s and also produce, you know, extraordinarily good wine. That they're really not that valuable unless they produce great wine.
Right. So what are some of the vineyards?
Well, for instance, one of the most famous is the Old Hill Vineyard in Sonoma, and Ravenswood has done for years a Old Hill Vineyard bottling, and Brandlin, which is the family that owns it, also does an Old Hill Vineyard bottling. And that's a vineyard that goes back, you know, the origins go back to the mid-1880s, and it's got Zinfandel in it, but it's got, you know, all sorts of other esoteric varieties, because a lot of the planting back then was just farmers sort of planting one variety next to each other in a field blend, essentially. So when you pull grapes from the vineyard, you're getting an extraordinary variety and range of flavors and characters, in a sense.
So are those – a lot of those other grapes that are planted there, do they actually end up in the Zinfandels that are made now?
They do. You know, for one thing, you know, with California wines, if you label it Zinfandel or you label it Cabernet, whatever you label it, you can have 25% of other varieties in there legally. So a vineyard like Old Hill, if you do a Zinfandel from it, it may be 20% Cunoise, it may be 5% Mouvet, it may be, you know, lots of little percentages of other things. If you go above 75%, then people tend to use the term mixed blacks for mixed red grapes. It's an old farming term for it. Or you simply label it by the vineyard. So if you look at Ridge's Geyserville wine, you know, it's predominantly Zin. It's like 65% Zin, but it's a bunch of old varieties mixed in with that from the Geyserville vineyard.
It's really interesting that farmers would do that. They'd actually plant the blend in the field so that they save themselves the time.
Well, yeah, save themselves the trouble. I mean, part of it is also you hedge your bets in a sense in terms of the weather and the season, because if you plant, you know, some early ripening varieties and some late ripening varieties and some kind of in the middle, then if you have a cold year, you're guaranteed that some are going to be ripe. And if you have a hot year, you're guaranteed that some aren't going to be overripe. And it kind of balances things out. The other thing is that, you know, if you look at modern winemaking, especially from high-end California wines, you have people planting by grape variety and then fermenting the wines in tiny little, you know, one-ton tanks. You know, a high-end winery may have 50, 60 one-ton stainless steel tanks. Whereas, you know, back then you had one guy with a vineyard and a big redwood tank.
Right. and that was it.
Whatever he happened to chuck into it.
Exactly. But why preserve these wines? I mean, is this biodiversity?
You know, absolutely. It is biodiversity to an extent, because a lot of these old vineyards have varieties planted in them that simply aren't cultivated anymore. You know, some that are probably close to extinction and some that are just not popular or never won out in the kind of, you know, Darwinian, you know, yeah, Cabernet and Chardonnay take all sweepstakes.
Right. So the group that wants to try to save them, are they fighting modern economy? Because from what I understand, a lot of these small vineyards, you know, a developer comes along, can offer them a fortune.
Absolutely. I mean, I think when, you know, you see this particularly when there's a booming housing market, and especially when you get places where these really old vineyards are sort of butt up against actual housing, Contra Costa County, for instance, you know, suddenly the land can be worth far, far more as a apartment complex than it will ever be as a vineyard. And, you know, the next generation's financial equation may be to say, well, you know, Dad farmed this for 80 years, but, you know, shoot, we can sell the land for $400,000 an acre. Why? Yeah. What are we doing with this farm? It's hard to farm. So, you know, so that's a tricky thing. And also fashion plays a role in it too, because you know, in Sonoma, for instance, you had some really beautiful old vine Zinfandel vineyards being pulled out to be replanted with Pinot Noir, because Pinot Noir is so popular right now. So what the historic grape Vineyard Society is trying to do, you know, in addition to just cataloging these places and kind of identifying them, which is the first step, I think that what they're aiming to do eventually is trying to create some sort of tax incentives from the government to keep these things in the ground and, you know, help farmers get a reasonable price for the grapes that will allow them to be sustainable.
Uh-huh. Okay, but in the meantime, before they may disappear, can you give us a few ideas of what to look for in the market?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a number of really terrific wines out there. You know, like there's a guy named Fred Scherer in Sonoma who makes spectacularly good Zinfandel from a 85-year-old vineyard that's been in his family forever. His father still farms it. You know, he said he actually tried to get his dad to stop, and his dad would just get up earlier and earlier to prevent him from getting in touch with him while he was in the vineyard. You know, Scherer's wines are lovely. The Ravenswood wines, the single vineyard Ravenswood Zinfandels, which are all out there, Dickerson and Teldeschi and Old Hill, those are beautiful old vine expressions of Zinfandel. Bedrock Wine Company, which is actually Morgan Twain Peterson, who's the son of Joel Peterson, who founded Ravenswood, he's making some gorgeous wines, and the Turley Zinfandels that Tegan Pasalacqua is making are lovely. And there's, you know, some are hard to find, but you can find their basic old vines blend around, and that's a melange of kind of several of these vineyards put
right.
together.
Fascinating. Ray, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Ray Isle is the executive wine editor for Food & Wine magazine. Now, you can learn more about California's historic vineyards by going to our website, splendidtable.org. Stay with us for a side of Moroccan food that you may not have heard about and why turning your oven above 300 is a waste of time. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Countries in 18 months with one simple goal: learn how people live from the work of their hands and their lands. Well, this is the perennialplate.com. It's the creation of Chef Daniel Klein and videographer Mira Fine. Now, they're into what you do not find in the guidebooks, and they're determined to learn what food really is to the people of the world. Daniel, Mira, it's good to have you back with us.
So good to be here.
Great to be here.
You two are always heading for places that tourists never find. And I understand the most recent trip was to Morocco. So, you know, what happened?
Morocco was a really amazing place to visit. But it was the first place where having a camera actually made it more difficult for us to be there. You know, normally when we go to each country, having a camera opens doors for us so we can go to different places, see behind the scenes.
Ask awkward questions,
and people are open to talking to us. In Morocco, people were very turned off by the camera. Many people didn't want their face filmed at all. We had to film only hands. Many people just didn't want the camera at all. So when they saw us with the camera, they turned away.
But you did have, from what I understand, you had a really rare experience. You were with a group of nomads in a rather remote area,
yeah.
If I got it right?
We hiked about 3 hours up the Tadra Gorge and were able to spend a night with a family of nomads in their camp, which is essentially their tent where they've lived for 12 years. And then they've built caves in the mountain, and we got to sleep in one of the caves, which was amazing.
What was that like?
I mean, it was really, really intense, actually. This is a trip that, I mean, Intrepid Travel sends people up to have tea with this family normally as kind of a realistic experience, but they don't usually spend, you know, the full day and the night.
Right.
And so when we got up there, you know, a strikingly beautiful, this simple and austere way of life, and then a windstorm happened. So we're we're up there, and the wind starts blowing, and we have you know, camera gear with us, which is pretty nerve-wracking.
Yes.
Pretty much the worst thing you can do to a camera is
expose it to a windstorm.
Yeah. You know, your eyes get full of dust, and seeing these, you know, like, you know, 4-year-old kid just endure it and still be playing and stuff like that. But the one thing we got to try a little bit of the food that they make. They herd goats, and we met with the herders, and
their daughter and their son. And it was so cool because at sunset, all of a sudden, I mean, the goats weren't there, and at sunset, hundreds of goats just came over the horizon in this like beautiful scene.
And then the daughter came and milked the goats, and then they took the goat milk and they put it in the skin of a goat and proceeded to shake it for, you know, half an hour or something like that. Not fast, just sort of a little bit more casual than I would have thought.
Right.
And then they untied the neck of the goat skin and out plopped these plop is the word because they had a little bowl and it kind of just fell.
It made that sound.
And it's this fresh goat's milk butter.
Oh, my.
And
what did it taste like?
It was really...
fresh.
It was fresh. It was a little bit, not acidic, but there was something to it.
Yeah. A gaminess, perhaps? I mean that in an interesting way, like goat's cheese.
Yeah, you know when you taste goat cheese?
Maybe like lemony or there's something else that was very citrusy to it.
Well, we tried it twice and one way that they do it is they let it sit overnight and throughout the day. And so it develops a bit of a fermented character to it. So it gets that tangy.
Well, that sounds delicious.
Sweetness. And so after taking the butter out, then they pour the fermented milk, which is like kefir or buttermilk.
Exactly.
But fermented buttermilk. And, you know, poured us a cup of that. And I have to say, you know, we get to eat a number of strange things, but drinking yogurt out of a goat's skin, we were a little worried. But the taste, you know, is like sour and little chunks of butter still left in it. So it's this creamy, sweet, sour. It's really delicious.
And you really don't care.
Yeah.
So here you are up in the mountains in a remote area with a family of nomads. But then I understand you ended up at the sea with an oyster farm. I mean, it's a pretty extreme contrast.
So we drove all around Morocco. And as we passed, we left Casablanca and we drove, I think, like 2 hours. And all of a sudden, we passed this hill and you look out and there's this amazing, beautiful lagoon. And we pulled up to this water and then we saw that there were lots of oyster traps? Is it oyster traps?
Oyster beds.
Oyster beds.
Never think of oyster farming in Morocco.
You don't think of that. But Walidia, which is the city where we went, is actually known for farming oysters. And they've been doing it since, I think, the 1950s.
You know, the French have been in Morocco for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And the French like their oysters. And so some smart Frenchman decided, hey, we should grow oysters in Morocco, and they happened to be this location that worked perfectly for raising oysters because the lagoon sort of empties out and then fills back with the tide, and so it exposes the beds to the sun, and you can rotate them easily, and then the water comes back in and flushes it out. So
they wait until the tide goes out, essentially, and that's when they harvest the oysters?
Yeah, exactly.
And the people that raise them, I mean, are they cooking them or are they generally going solely to, you know, the foreigners who come?
They are very often go to the foreigners who come. But the interesting...
We went to this amazing fish market in Casablanca and we saw lots of Moroccan families buying oysters and eating them. So I think it was designed for the French,
foreigners.
But we did see plenty of Moroccan people indulging in them. And it's quite interesting because the family that runs the oyster farm that we visited had their oyster operation, and next to it was a restaurant. But they did not run the restaurant because the restaurant served alcohol, and that was against their religion. So we were able to have a glass of wine and eat our oysters.
So these two experiences, real extremes in how people live.
For sure.
Hey, thank you both for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Mira Fine and Daniel Klein are the creators of PerennialPlate.com. Now, for more information on their adventures, just go to the website, splendidtable.org. want real convenience food? Well, set your oven at around 275. Pick up the book Cooking Slow, Recipes for Slowing Down and Cooking More by Andrew Schloss. Check out what's in your fridge and pick a recipe that fits. Slide it into the oven and forget about it for a couple of hours. Now that's convenience. Most things that take to slow cooking also take to reheating, so you've got dinner for the rest of the week. Now, Andy Schloss is a rethinker. He takes nothing for granted, and he loves Sherlocking the science of a dish. Andy, good to have you back.
It's wonderful to be with you, Lynn.
So what is the difference between what happens when you cook slowly versus the usual way we normally cook?
All of cooking is a balance between temperature and time. As you start to lower temperatures and naturally extend time because it just takes longer to cook it, you affect the way heat works with the foods differently. And the most profound effect is in proteins. Meats will become done at a certain temperature. So a rare roast beef, for instance, is 130 degrees. If I'm roasting that beef in a 400-degree oven, the outside of the beef is getting well done. It's getting up to 400 degrees in order to get that center to be perfectly rare. If I have my oven set at 130 degrees, the entire beef is rare, and I get the juiciness all the way through, and the texture of the protein, the way it sets up, is just very, very soft. You get a huge difference when you slow down that process and lower the temperatures.
Does it actually – I mean, it sounds like it's affecting the cellular structure of the meat.
Yes.
Is it that when those cells are heated very quickly or taken to a very high temperature, there's actually shrinkage that releases moisture?
Yes, proteins will shrink up. They get tighter as they get hotter. You see this most like when you fry an egg or scramble an egg. Uh-huh. If you put the egg in the pan, you can see that the protein at first is clear and liquidy. And then as the heat affects it, it will start to tighten up and become white and opaque. And eventually, like if your pan is really hot when you put a fried egg in there,
right,
it almost turns to like a plastic at the edge. That's very overcoagulated protein. So if you never let that temperature get that high, the protein stays soft and succulent and tender the entire time.
So what happens with vegetables? Is it the same premise?
With vegetables, it is not as profound an effect. And it was interesting because one of the things I thought would be great in this book was roasting vegetables. And the roasted vegetables I like better cooked at a high temperature. So I ended up not doing a lot of roasted vegetables. An example of a vegetable that I did that was amazing were roasted carrots on coffee beans, which was a technique that I picked up from the restaurant Qua in San Francisco. And what happens there is you lay carrots on coffee beans. And the coffee, at a very low temperature, the oils in the coffee beans emerge. They start to weep out of the coffee beans and infuse into the carrots. So it's different than a carrot rubbed with coffee or poached in liquid coffee. It almost is like it's inundated with the spirit of coffee. It's an amazing thing that happens. I also did that with beets, and it was wonderful.
It sounds incredible. I mean, it really does sound incredible. All right, but now we get to the issue that the danger area in temperatures where harmful bacteria could grow is between 40 and 140 degrees. And you have that meat sitting there very slowly getting to even below that temperature. So what about the safety issues, especially with proteins, of cooking very slowly?
Whenever you're dealing with a solid protein, with a solid piece of meat or something like that, all of those bacteria are on the surface of the roast. There's not a significant amount of bacteria interior in the muscle. And that's why in ground meat, it's much more of a problem because in ground meat, the outside becomes the inside. But as long as the meat is a solid piece, that bacteria is on the outside. So whenever you're slow cooking roast, you want to do some measure to alleviate the amount of bacteria on the surface of the meat. And that is either done through browning, just in a pan before you put it in the oven, or you can start it at a very high oven. I usually, if I'm doing that, I'll start at 425 and let it go for 30 minutes or so, so the surface becomes at least up to 200, 300 degrees before I lower the temperature, or sometimes with like poultry where I don't want to brown it a lot first, I will salt the meat, or I can do this with roast too. Put a good amount of salt on the surface of the meat and let it sit in the refrigerator overnight, which will subside the amount of bacteria on the surface,
right.
And you wipe that salt off, and it seasons the meat as well.
Okay. You do something in the book that's really unusual. You slow bake desserts. How does that work?
Well, this was something I discovered because I'm lazy. I discovered this. I used to work in restaurants when I was younger, and I always wanted to have something cooking while I was sleeping. And I was thinking about – I had a lot of cheesecakes on my menu at that point, and cheesecakes are just custards where – instead of having milk as your liquid, you have cream cheese as your liquid, or ricotta cheese, or whatever your dairy is in the custard. All the recipes I had ever seen baked the cheesecake in a water bath. And the purpose of baking in a water bath is it keeps the median temperature around the food at 212 degrees maximum. So I was thinking, why can't I just set my oven at 200 degrees and then I don't need a water bath? I did that, and it was amazing. Because the cheesecake never overcooked. You know how the edges of a custard will get sort of grainy? Because they'll get hotter than the center will.
Yeah.
This didn't happen. It was perfect from middle to edges. So I started doing custard-like desserts, puddings, cheesecakes, cream pies, fruitcakes, things that don't require a lot of gluten production to raise the cake. And lowering those temperatures, and it worked amazingly. The one thing when you do that, when you're lowering your oven temperature down to 200 or even like 180 degrees to set the batter, the baking time starts to extend. And these cheesecakes that I was doing, it turned out that they took about 8 hours to get done, which was about the amount of time that I slept. So I realized that I could just, at the end of the night, stick the cheesecakes in the oven, go home, go to sleep, come back in the morning, and I'd add desserts. For the restaurant.
I love this. Andy, thank you. Great ideas.
Wonderful talking to you, Lynn.
Andrew Schloss is author of Cooking Slow, Recipes for Slowing Down and Cooking More. Now, that recipe for carrots slow cooked on coffee beans, it's amazing. And you can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. We're going to be back with your calls, tweets, and other communiques. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is time for you and me to connect. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. Now, that's exactly what Chris is doing from Boston. Chris, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
How are you? Thank you so much for taking my call.
Well, I'm swell, and you're welcome.
I have a question for you. My girlfriend, Lydia, started at Tulane Law in New Orleans.
And, oh, my.
I will be doing quite a few visits from Boston, and I don't know the first thing about how to get used to New Orleans food. And as a Irish-Italian mutt from Boston, born and raised, it's a little bit different.
It's a wee bit different, but you know what? It's not all that different. Here's the deal, okay? What you're going to find in New Orleans, first of all, is a lot of French overtone to the food. And at times, a lot of spice, because that's the Cajun influence. You're going to find, for instance, a Creole sauce, in big quotes, is tomatoes, green peppers, garlic, onion, and maybe a tad of spice. Now, does that sound vaguely Italian?
Because it sounds a little Italian.
You get the idea. You're going to find in the classical, upscale New Orleans kind of eating, things done in wonderful wine sauces and occasionally with cream. But the real glory of New Orleans food are the things like the andouille sausage, which is spicy and big flavors, kind of like an Italian sausage. And by the way, oysters, seafood, but especially oysters, fried oysters, poor boys. Now, a poor boy is like a submarine or a hero sandwich, right? Except it's you want it with fried oysters. That's what you want. Shrimp in everything. And flavors that have punctuation marks behind them.
That's awesome. I knew you were the person to ask.
Well, Chris, enjoy it. She couldn't have picked a better. You know, I think more people should be picking where they study by where the food is.
That's a really good point.
You've got a good one there. Have fun,
She's
Chris.
Pretty great. All right. Thank you so much, Lynn.
You take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, boy. Studying at Tulane, being in New Orleans? I hope she makes it to class. Meredith is on the line from Washington, D.C. Meredith, do you have a question?
I have a question about apples. Just a few weekends ago, I went apple picking at a farm in suburban Maryland and got several pounds of Stamen and Braeburn apples with the intention of doing something besides pie.
Well, I mean, one of the things that's really kind of fun to do, I think, is apple butter. Because apple butter is where essentially you make a homemade applesauce and then you cook it down and you cook it down and you cook it down. And you put a bit of sugar into taste and you can spice it any way you want. But essentially what you're going for is that intense, deep apple flavor. And there's a lot of recipes out there for apple butter. That's okay. One thing. Now, another thing you could do is to do a apple sorbet. And again, I'd say look up a recipe. But the best sorbets to me are really fruit purees where you cut up that apple. Mm-hmm. Take the seeds out, but you want that skin. And you take those slices, lay them out on some parchment or whatever, put them in the freezer and freeze them. And then puree that in a food processor with a bit of sugar syrup. Or just sugar. And then what you're doing, it's not a true sorbet. It's really almost like a granita, but that's, we're getting into semantics. You put that into a shallow container and you freeze it. And then when you want to know you want to be serving it, you know, let's say that evening, let it defrost a little and give it a stir with a fork and put it back in the freezer. And then do that again until it gets kind of shaggy. And that's when, you serve it. I think this is one of the loveliest things because you can serve it for a dessert. You can serve it, you know, between courses. You know, you can put it in little shot glasses, put a bit of salt on top of it, and it can become something you just have with drinks.
That's what's going to actually make me think maybe to do it like with an herb or something like.
Oh, yeah. Basil is.
Like thyme.
Exactly. And it becomes more savory. Nuts can go into it. A little bit of a liqueur of some kind that you might like. A little shot of apple brandy would be not bad in something like that.
Okay. Those definitely sound really fun. And I guess I would be remiss if I didn't ask for maybe a fun twist on apple pie. Over the years, I've been designated as the family apple pie maker for Thanksgiving.
Uh-huh.
So sometimes I try to experiment a little bit. I've done something in the past, like with the Mexican brown sugar and cinnamon. And
ooh, that's a great idea. One thing I love to do is mix dried apples with the fresh apples, and it'll intensify it.
Oh, well, that sounds good.
Another thing is something like dried figs that you cut up.
Okay.
That you soak first to just soften them, and you cut them up into small pieces, and you toss that with the apples. It just adds a lovely flavor to it. And, of course, black pepper is wonderful with apples. Just a little kick of black pepper in there, along with the spices. So there are a few ideas.
Well, thank you very much. I've got a lot to work with here.
Hey, thank you, Meredith. Take care.
Thank you, Lynn. You too.
Michelle is on the line from London. Welcome. What's your question, Michelle?
Well, over the weekend, I got very excited and decided to make some jam with some blackberries.
Right.
First time I've ever done it. I think I've completely overcooked it. It tastes fine, but it looks to me like it's quite sort of dry, and it's solid as anything.
Yeah.
I'm never going to spread it on toast, and I just don't know what to do with all these jars and jars of blackbread jam that I now have.
Oh, you know what you're describing? The first time I made jam. I was so worried I wasn't going to cook it enough.
Yes.
And now you've got blocks. Okay, number one, consider this, all right? You may have an asset, all right? If you can heat the outside of the jars and turn the jam out of the jars, right?
Mm-hmm.
Cut it into cubes, and that's what you can put in salads.
Oh, that'd be lovely.
Especially if you had thin sliced onions that you had marinated in a little vinegar for contrast and toss that with greens. I would also do the same idea to garnish platters of desserts or with cheeses. You could slice it in thin slices and put it out. You know the way Latin America, fruits are cooked down until they're gelled. And then, you know, especially quince. And then it's thin sliced and served with fresh cheese. Well, it's the same idea with your jam.
Oh, wow.
Do you do any baking at all, like pie or anything?
I do, yeah.
Okay. Pre-bake your bottom crust of the pie lightly. Okay, so, you know, it dries up a bit and it doesn't get soggy. And then if you're going to make a custard pie, a fruit pie, any kind of pie, thin slice your jam and lay it on the bottom of that pie crust so that what happens is you then pour in the filling. And I don't care if it's apples or, you know, if it's whatever, right? And that bakes and it melts and it becomes this coating at the bottom that you hit as a surprise.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
And the other thing you can do is reverse that and put it on the top of a pie. Even a two-crusted pie, just before you take it out of the oven, put bits of your solid jam and let it melt into that crust and caramelize just a wee bit. And it'll be a mystery. No one will know what it is. No, but I'm very serious. And now I wouldn't call it jam. Why don't you call it something like, you know, blackberry jelly?
Sounds amazing.
I think, you know, make it an asset. In fact, you may have something to market there.
Thank you so much. That's absolutely fantastic.
You enjoy yourself, Michelle, and thanks for calling.
No sweat. Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Tom's on the line from Youngstown, Ohio. Tom, hi. What do you want to talk about?
I'd like to roast a leg of lamb outdoors on a spit over a fire.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. You mean over like a real fire as opposed to charcoal briquettes?
Right.
Ah, okay.
I'd like to know what type of wood would taste best with lamb and what combination of wood and spices would be best?
Well, first of all, you want a hardwood. Some people love to use fruit wood, so that would mean apple, cherry wood. What do you have access to is the first question.
Apple and cherry are the two that I have, you know, the best access to.
Okay. So you want to build the fire in a way that you're going to let it cook down and you've got the hot coals and you've got a really thick bed of them, you know, about, 6 inches deep. And you're going to feed the fire, but you're going to feed the fire from the outside so you don't have flames licking under that spit.
Okay.
And you want the lamb elevated above that fire by about, 10 inches or more. Okay. And you're going to use a meat thermometer. And, of course, a lot of this is going to be guesswork. It depends on the temperature outside. You're in Youngstown, Ohio, so maybe you want to get it down a little closer to the fire. Otherwise, it's going to take a very, very, very long time. So here's the deal. I would use, if you've got a lot of it, I would do it completely over the fruit wood. And it's going to probably take a couple of hours. And you want to build up a really deep bed of hot coals. And you want to drip pan underneath the lamb. And then the coals are around it. And you're going to keep turning it and you're going to keep basting it. Now, from the pan drippings, but you can also be basting it with wine, with whatever you think you want. Now, you could do, if you've got apple wood, it would be interesting to do a combination of apple cider and white wine and herbs. And if you take the lamb the day before and you make deep, deep pockets in it and you stuff it with the herbs that you want to taste or with the flavors you want to taste, Now, it may be that you want to cut up apples and you want some shallots in there and you want some spices that please you. That'll start to permeate the lamb. You leave that in the fridge overnight. But I do a slow turn on the spit. And if you want the lamb medium rare, you want it at around 130 when you take it off, 125 to 130 when you take it off the spit, and then you let it rest for about 10 minutes. I would do that around 130 at the very most, only because, well, you have to see what the center of the lamb is, because the center of the lamb is going to be the most important thing. At the thickest part of the meat, if the center of the lamb is at about 130, then the outside is going to be much more done. But since it's a triangular shaped piece of meat, everybody's going to get something different. Some part of it's going to be well done, some part of it's going to be rare, some part of it's going to be medium rare. And know what you can do? You can bury the sides in the coals. Potatoes, artichokes, onions, apples, I mean, you name it, whole vegetables. It'd be fabulous.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Thank you very much, Lynn.
Well, thank you, Tom. Take care.
Okay.
Bye.
You too. Bye.
You can check us out on Facebook and Twitter. You can send us an email, splendidtable.org. Or you can call us, 800-537-5252. Does guilt close in when you realize you have to throw away leftovers? Well, now there's an app for that. With 40% of our food ending up in the trash, this app could have a future. It's called Leftover Swap. Jennifer Russell caught up with the Leftover Swap co-founder, Dan Newman.
Hey, Dan.
Hi.
So you've come up with this Leftover Swap app. What is it, and how does it work?
So Leftover Swap, it's like Craigslist for your leftovers. Pretty much, if you have extra food, you can put it on our application, and someone can come pick it up.
Okay. How did you come up with this idea? There has to be a story.
Yes. So it was actually born 3 years ago. I was visiting my old college roommate out in Seattle, and Seattle is such a great food city. And that's the problem we had at one point. We ordered way too much pizza, and my friend's fridge was completely full, so we had no place to put it, and it was just going to go to waste. And we thought how great of an idea it would be to broadcast that we had this extra pizza available.
I love it. And you touch on some important issues around this app.
Definitely. There's food waste, there's hunger, there's obesity, there's community. We waste 40% of the food that is created in the U.S., and 15% of Americans don't have enough food for adequate lifestyle. And, 70% of us are obese. And I think the stat that is most troubling to me is 25% of us don't know our neighbors' names, not one neighbor, which is incredible to me.
Hmm. So I'm sure that you have a variety of responses, and I would imagine that there are a lot of people that are sort of icked out by the concept.
So of course.
Tell me, what's the reaction been like? What have you heard?
So it has been very divisive. There are people who absolutely are ecstatic about it, and those will definitely be our cheerleaders in the community to help grow the network that we need to make this successful. And there are also people who it's not going to be for. They're going to stay as far away from it as possible. However, I think there are a lot of people in the middle ground who, at first, when they think of leftovers, they automatically associate that with something that they've left in the fridge for 2 weeks and think that that's what they're going to be giving other people or taking from other people. But when those people start to think about it for more than that immediate reaction, I think they get a sense of what else could actually be shared through this. For example, if you have extra tomatoes from your home garden, or you've gone on a big shopping trip to Costco and can't possibly use all 30 pounds of potatoes that you bought, there really is no limit to where it can be taken.
That's cool. So how does it work? Are there any rules?
So when you have extra food that you'd like to give away or perhaps trade, you take a picture of it, and that'll drop a pin on the map, and pretty much you wait for someone to contact you through the application. And on the other side, if you're looking for some extra food, you go to this map, and you can look through all the different pins that are placed, and contact the person.
Ah, all right. So how far-reaching will this app be?
So the first version will be for iPhones, and that's anywhere the English App Store is available, which is obviously a large portion of the world. And it's actually incredible the response that we've gotten from outside the U.S. as well. It's been very much discussed in Britain and Europe and Canada and South Africa. So it has legs globally, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's good timing. It's a really interesting movement, I think.
Yes, very good timing.
Dan, thanks for your time. We'll be following along.
Thank you very much.
Dan Newman is co-founder of Leftover Swap. Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk next week, and in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Jared Kins, who said, "Leave me with my leftover meatloaf and my yesterday sandwich. I'll be in love tomorrow if you come back with the ketchup." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, we're doing something important here at The Splendid Table this month. We're partnering with Feeding America to bring assistance to people who are hungry. Hunger happens in every community, rural or urban, and it impacts all of us. When you support The Splendid Table this holiday season, your gift will not only help us produce our program, but will help provide meals to people in need through Feeding America's network of member food banks. In these months of feasting and celebration for many of us, let's remember those who are going without. Visit splendidtable.org to get more information on our partnership with Feeding America, as well as information on anything else you heard here today. See you next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.